It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
Coming up on episode number 92 of Sports Day Plus. At 6:30, it's the first of a two-segment chat with a musician best known as Sin Cane. He's got a new album out today called We Belong. I had the opportunity to speak with him about that and more during South by Southwest last month. And in mere seconds, it is a replay of my conversation with the legendary Tony Hawk, who will be in town for a really cool event this weekend. I am your host, Trey Elling. You can give me a follow on Twitter at Courtesy Wave and do the same for ESPN Austin at 1027 ESPN. Tony Hawk is maybe the most well-known skateboarder on the planet who has been shredding ramps and parks and elsewhere for more than 45 years now. Over that 45 plus years, he has become one of those most recognizable names, first as a skater, then as a video game character, and now in his mid-50s as maybe the most important ambassador for the activity itself. And he's bringing his story along with the stories of a fellow legendary skateboarder to Austin at ACL Live at the Moody Theater this Sunday night at 7 p.m. The show is titled Dark Slides and Secret Tapes, An Evening with Tony Hawk and Rodney Mullen. You can go to acllive.com to snag tickets. And Tony now joins me to talk about that and a whole lot more. Tony, thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning to you as well. We were just lamenting before hitting record that we each have to take care of getting our kids up and out of the house and to school on most weekdays. And some days, I'm never going to call it easy, but some days are a little bit less difficult than others.
Yes. And yeah, my schedule is dictated by hers for sure, but she's almost driving. So pretty soon it's going to be on her to get up and out and to all of the other extracurricular activities.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I've got 9 and 7 right now. You've got a bunch of different kids. The oldest may be early 30s. All the way down to 15. Yeah. Does it get easier once they get to adolescence and adulthood?
Wow, that's no. That's the short answer. They just need more complicated stuff when they get older.
Gotcha, gotcha.
They need you to help with, you know, paperwork and home loans and bigger advice. So that it gets more complicated, but yes, it gets easier in the sense that for the most part, they are self-sufficient.
So you may not remember this, but this is yours and my second time to talk. The first time was at South by Southwest 2 years ago. You and Sam Jones were premiering the exceptional documentary on your life. And I will always remember that because I watched one of the most physically impressive things pulled off that I will ever witness. And it had to do with you, but it had nothing to do with the skateboard, or I guess passively had to do with the skateboard because it was about the documentary. You had broken your femur like 4 or 5 days before. And there were questions as to whether you were even going to be showing up. Not only did you show up, you were on crutches. You insisted on passing the crutches off while you were doing interviews too. My mind was blown. I was the guy that congratulated you on your middle name officially involving the F word going forward. You had reached that level by pulling something off so incredible. Unfortunately, in researching for this conversation, I came to learn that that was at the defiance of doctor's orders. 8 months later, you realized things hadn't healed up properly and you had to go in for another surgery. Is that injury healed up like it should have now since we're 2 years removed from the injury itself?
Yeah, for the most part, I'm still dealing with some residual effects of it in terms of my limitations when I skate, but they're nuanced. You know, they're more just from things that I notice that no one else would notice in terms of my like how far I can get, how much I can crouch and sort of squat and things like that. But that was going to come with age anyway. I just accelerated the process by breaking my leg. But it wasn't South by Southwest that set me on the wrong trajectory. It was more when I got back from South by Southwest, I started skating immediately and that was the wrong decision.
Yeah, because I remember you talking about wanting to get to an event in Vegas in April, which was a month away. Yeah. And so did you make that event to the detriment of your long-term
health?
That
event actually got canceled, not because of my injury, but because of other issues. But that wasn't stopping my my motivations, and it should have. Let's just put it this way. In hindsight, I should have known better.
Sure, sure. So I'm really excited that you're bringing Dark Slides and Secret Tapes, An Evening with Tony Hawk and Rodney Mullen, to Austin. It's this Sunday, April 7th at 7 p.m. As far as I know, there's only two shows that are scheduled right now. Maybe that's going to expand at some point in the future. So what can people expect if they show up at the Moody Center on Sunday night to hear you and Rodney talk?
Well, it's going to be, it's a collaborative talk. We've never done anything like this before where he and I are taking turns telling our stories and giving the parallels to our lives and our journeys. And, it's interesting because he and I both grew up skiing at the same time, but on different ends of the opposite coasts, and both felt like we were outsiders in an outsider sport, but found camaraderie within each other and found inspiration within each other. And it's been like that ever since. I mean, it's been kind of shocking how our lives have gone in the same way, even though we didn't really hang out a whole lot. We definitely always had a kindred spirit, but even down to, like, I broke my leg and a year later, Rodney had double hip replacement. And so we were both on the road to recovery at the same time, just by happenstance. But Rodney is fascinating. And I mean, he really is the godfather of modern skateboarding, in terms of, he's the guy that created the kickflip. He's the guy that figured out how to ollie with your board off the ground. And all along, he was doing that by himself with no accolades at the time. And, you know, I was doing my own version of that, skating pools and ramps where no one was really paying attention. But at the same time, we both felt this drive to keep trying, keep getting better, even when we were competing and doing well.
You talked about the community, which for me, as somebody who may have tried skateboarding for a small amount of time when I was a kid, has always found myself fascinated by the community. I mean, that was really accelerated, I guess, for a lot of the general public with the X Games and just watching everybody root for everybody else, which at the time was a foreign concept, certainly in American sports. I'm not sure how it was around the rest of the world, although thinking about soccer hooligans, that's probably not always the case either. What is it about the skateboarding community that makes that group so special?
I think it's the idea that, well, first of all, especially in our days, you had to be somewhat of a rebel to even choose skateboarding, because it was not cool. And it was largely largely made fun of by the sort of mainstream crew. And it was almost like if you chose a skateboard, especially in the early 80s, the narrative was, how could you keep skating? Like, why haven't you grown out of this? Aren't you too old for that? There were so few places to skate that you had to sort of create your own spaces, and you had to figure out how to use the landscape, like the urban landscape and the street areas to make it your own skate park. So there's this strong bond between skaters, because they've already felt like they were pushed aside. And so they had to band together. But also there's a mindset in terms of doing it your own way, doing your own thing, but also being part of a community. I mean, most other sports rely on teamwork for success. And in skateboarding, it's more based on what are the challenges you put forth for yourself and how do you overcome them? And there'll be a whole group of people that will support you in that, but they're not competing against you. And I think that's the difference.
He is the legendary Tony Hawk, going to be here in Austin this weekend, has a really cool event at ACL Live at the Moody Theater on Sunday night at 7 o'clock. It's called Dark Slides and Mixtapes, An Evening with Tony Hawk and Rodney Mullen. You can go to ACLLive.com to grab the tickets that remain right now. Coming up on the other side, I continue my conversation with Tony right here on Sports Day Plus.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Ellie.
Back with legendary skateboarder Tony Hawk. You not only know him from those skateboarding skills in the 1980s, but he was one of the main forces behind skateboarding's gain in popularity with the X Games in the 90s and the 2000s. He is the guy that the video game was created after, Tony Hawk Pro Skater. And in modern times, even in his mid-50s, not only is he still shredding, but he's also maybe the most important ambassador for this activity. And Tony is actually going to be here in Austin this Sunday at ACL Live at the Moody Theater, along with another legendary skateboarder. The show is called Dark Slides and Secret Tapes, an evening with Tony Hawk and Rodney Mullen. Again, Sunday at 7 p.m. You can get tickets right now by going to that ACL Live website. That is ACLLive.com. It is going to be a lot of fun. They're going to talk about highlights from their career and some things that maybe haven't been mentioned in the public sphere before. And Austin is only one of two places to actually get this show as of right now. The other is the Beacon Theater in New York. So you definitely do not want to miss it. This Sunday, ACLLive.com. Tony, there have been different moments throughout time that have really helped to advance skateboarding culture. Your video game, obviously, a part of that, the X Games. But one of the first real pop culture events to advance skateboarding was Back to the Future back in the mid-1980s.
True, yes.
Back to the Future 2 happened as well, which had a bunch of cool future inventions, including that hoverboard, which I don't think we have a prototype for just yet. Has anybody approached you with an idea for a hoverboard, and do you think that's something we'll see in our lifetime?
I have ridden a hoverboard. It is nothing like what you think of in Back to the Future. It was much larger. It was much louder. You had to ride above a specific type of surface. And it was very hard to control. So it was more like I was along for the ride on a board that just chose to start spinning when I didn't want it to. But that was a while ago. That was almost 10 years ago. So I do feel like the technology is moving ahead. It's just not cost effective yet.
Yeah.
And it's definitely not what you think of when you think of that movie. I will tell you though, that I recently bought one of the hoverboards from the movie, that was one of the props. So I do have a hoverboard from Back to the Future. It's just a piece of plastic.
How much did that cost you?
Enough. Let's just say I would not be outbid on it.
Gotcha. So as far as the X Games are concerned, I've heard, by the way, skateboarding writing is as beautiful as the art form itself in a lot of ways. And I think that's because you have a lot of introspective people who have interesting things to say, and they do that best by writing it down. But I've seen criticisms at times from skateboarding purists, let's call them. And by the way, purists with any activity, they can make some good points, but it tends to be a miserable lot as well. I've heard skateboarding purists say that in a way the X Games hurt the pure art form of skateboarding. As somebody who was obviously an instrumental part of the X Games, do you understand where they're coming from with that?
I think that their complaint is more that suddenly skateboarding was grouped together with all these other so-called extreme sports. And we always felt like we chose to skate because it set us apart, because it was something different. And then suddenly you're grouped into all these sort of fringe activities. But at the same time, if you look a little deeper than that, skating is its own thing. And it definitely has shined through the X Games, especially from the early days X Games, when it was like rock climbing and bungee jumping and sky surfing and all these random other sports that all fell by the wayside in terms of being included in that. And so, but at the same time, the ESPN did not create competition within our sports. I've been competing since I was 10 years old. So I think that's the misperception of all this, is that somehow X Games or even Olympics are the ones who have started the competition idea of what we do. That's just patently false. We've been competing forever, and now it just happens to be on TV, and it just happens to be on an international stage.
A lot of those same writers do a great job of pointing out how skateboarding is such an excellent metaphor for life. Why do you love skateboarding as a metaphor for life, Tony?
Well, it teaches you the value of perseverance and following through And it's, I mean, there's never a better metaphor in life than to fail and keep trying. Get back up, try again. Don't give up. I mean, that's it. That's what skateboarding is about, not giving up.
Yeah. You have five kids. I have two, though most of yours are grown now, as we talked about previously. Parenting is always a challenge. What do you think the biggest challenge is for most parents in 2024 with all the crazy stuff that's come about in the last 5+ years?
I think it's social media, just communication in general. Yeah. You know, obviously I love that I can communicate with my kids in real time. I don't have to hope that they're home and by the phone. But you know, when you're talking about like all our boys are, we have five boys, they're all grown and on their own. And then our daughter's 15, she's still at home, but the influence of social media, the pressure of it is intense. And so the best thing you can do as a parent is just to give them a break from it or try to explain how it's not the most important thing. And the opinions are definitely ones you need to ignore.
A lot of times the opinions aren't even human. The opinions are literally coming from things like chatbots. So yeah,
sure,
more of a reason to take anything that you read on there with a grain of salt.
Of course. And I think that luckily they have me as an example that I grew up with that sort of bullying, but face to face. And then some, you know, eventually it became something that was online, but I was able to ignore it and learn to ignore it in a way that was healthy. And so once it came to social media, that was even easier to ignore because it was more anonymous. It wasn't someone getting in my face and telling me that, that what I do is wrong. So I think that they see me, hopefully that I'm an example to them. And that they know that they just have to take it to all, like you said, with a grain of salt. It's all nonsense.
So you have obviously traveled all over the world for your job, but you have admitted in previous interviews that you didn't initially have much of a travel bug. You're just a naive kid from Southern California. That's obviously changed over time because you've also talked about taking your kids on trips with you when they were younger and how important that was for them to just let them see other parts of the world, experience new cultures. Was there a trip or a specific place for you that really flipped the script with regards to how you felt about travel and just the importance of it all?
That's a good question. I think that when I started going on trips that were more charity focused, and there was no skating, I think that's what allowed me to really open up my eyes and appreciate other cultures and also just the challenges of other countries and different places. I mean, I was always just when I was young, I was fixated on skating. Where is the skate park? Where are we going? And everything else was incidental, including sightseeing. But then I went on a couple of trips to places like Africa, even Cambodia, and really saw a much broader worldview and was able to, I mean, sometimes be the one that showed them their first skateboard and took them on rides for it. Not that I was, you know, not that that was the motivating factor, but it was really fun for me to be able to show them this version of what could be fun. And once I had experienced all that and come home, you know, it was very, I thought it was important to expose my kids to all of the different cultures as much as possible. And, you know, they've gone on trips with us. They've helped to fit people with hearing aids that couldn't afford them. They've helped to teach kids in Africa to skate. And I'm really proud of them for embracing those opportunities.
Is that through your nonprofit, the Skateboard Project?
The skate park project, yeah, but also in connection with Skatistan, which is the international. They provide education and skate facilities to kids in very, very rough, underserved areas, and they've been doing it. I mean, they started in Afghanistan. They've expanded to Cambodia. They've expanded to South Africa. They're expanding to Jordan, and we've done a few of their projects, of their openings, of their schools, and it's magical.
All right, last question now, Tony. Accomplished people tend to ask themselves questions, and there tends to be one overriding question at a given point in time. Considering your level of accomplishment, what is that one question for you right now that you find yourself asking over and over again?
Will this resonate? And is this good for skateboarding? I think that's probably the number one question for me in terms of what I do with my career and how I spend my time. Does this represent skateboarding well? And is it fun?
I think that mindset is a big reason why you're looked at as the ultimate ambassador for the sport. You always have that art form in mind, and you're very conscious of that with the decisions that you make and the things that you try and do as well. So congratulations on all the successes up to this point. Man, I am excited for people to get to go to ACL Live at the Moody Theater this Sunday night at 7 o'clock. It is Dark Slides and Secret Tapes, and even with Tony Hawk and Rodney Mullen, going to be sharing stories or maybe some video clips that are going to get shared as well, and it's no doubt going to be a great time. Tony, thank you so much for the time today, man. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Jake. Appreciate it.
All right, coming up on the other side is a guy that I consider to be one of the most underrated musicians around. His name is Ahmed Jalib. He's better known by the stage name Sin Cane. He's got a new album out today called We Belong. I had the pleasure of speaking with him at South by Southwest about the new music and a whole lot more, and I'm bringing that to you next over a couple of segments right here on Sports Day Plus on 102.7 ESPN.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Ellie. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Ellie.
Ahmed Jalib is a musician who is better known by the stage name Sin Cane. Sin Cane blends progressive rock, electronica, free jazz, funk, afrobeat, Sudanese pop, and more, and has just come out with a brand new album as of today. It's titled We Belong, and a few weeks back at South by Southwest, I had a chance to sit down with Ahmed to talk about the new album and more. Ahmed, thank you so much for the time. How you doing today, man?
I'm good.
So you've been at South By all week long. You've been performing shows day after day. Here we are in the final day of South By Southwest. You're about to perform at the Soho House here in just a little bit. How has this South By been for you? Is this your first South By? And what are your overall impressions of the week?
This is not my first South By. I've worked at South By when I was an intern at a magazine a long time ago. So my first South By was 2006.
And oh, you're a veteran at this point, then.
Yeah. And Sin Cane's first performance at South By was 2012. So it's been a while since I've been here. But I'm very grateful. It's nice to know 15 years into my career, I can still be doing this. And the shows have been great. The band is killing. And, you know, it's a very different vibe here in Austin than I remember. But it feels easier than any other South By I think I've ever been on.
When was the last time you were here?
2012.
Oh, the last time you were here was more than a decade ago.
Oh, in Austin, you mean? Yeah. Like, period? 2019.
Okay, so pre-COVID, yeah. That was a lifetime ago.
Yeah, exactly. And it definitely didn't look like this back then. And, it's been, 5 years? And in 5 years, a lot of new things have popped up. So it's pretty cool to see.
Yeah, no doubt about that. So you're here in part because you've got a new album coming out on April 5th called We Belong. The bits and pieces that I've gotten to listen to have been up to standard and maybe then some. Just how excited are you to finally get to show this album to the people?
I'm very proud of this record. It's the best thing I think I've ever done. I think I finally found my voice. It just sounds exactly how I wanted it to sound. And just really happy for myself and everyone involved. You know, it took a village to make the record, and we really created something special.
You have said in previous interviews that you are always refining, you're always tinkering with every bit of new music that you do, but you feel like you did experience that breakthrough with this album. So what was the breakthrough?
I think I was able to finally put together all of my influences and interests in music in a way that felt exactly like myself. If I look back on previous records, I really see myself chipping away and like fine tuning and sanding and doing that kind of thing. And this time I was able to not really chip away. I just kind of figured out how to create my own vocabulary with all of the different ideas that I'm interested in.
So you've been at this for a while now, and in learning about your background, I was trying to think, like, when was the first time I heard a song of yours that I really fell in love with? And the song was How We Be. Mm-hmm. So I have a radio background, obviously. I have used that as a music bed forever. So first of all, thank you for the instrumental. But the song itself is also really good too. But I was looking at like where you had been up to that point, and it made a lot of sense. I'm like, this is why I discovered him, because you had worked with everyone from Of Montreal, Yesayer, Born Ruffians, and you do hear some of those musical influences within that band. But you admitted that once you really got Cinquain rolling, that it took you some time to get completely comfortable as a frontman once again. You had dabbled a little bit before working as a part of some of those other bands. So what was it that allowed you to get completely comfortable on stage as the guy at the front of this great band?
Making a lot of mistakes and kind of going into throwing myself into the deep end without having much experience as a frontman or as a band leader or as a businessman, really, to be honest, you know. It was really easy to be in Of Montreal and Yesayer and Born Ruffians and all of those bands, because it meant that I had no responsibility. I just showed up and played. You know, I got to do all the fun stuff, but I didn't realize how much more of the not fun stuff existed when you're doing your own thing. And I just wasn't ready for that. I didn't really have any experience, and I made a lot of mistakes, and I'm very grateful for those mistakes because I've learned a lot from them.
Was there a biggest mistake? And if so, what was the lesson?
I think just not having, not being assertive about my voice. That's really it. You know, like I think the it's just leadership, regardless of it being in music or other kinds of businesses or, you know, whatever it is, sports. You just have to be very assertive and have a lot of conviction behind what you're doing, and trust yourself. And I really didn't have that for a long time. And it led me into a lot of wrong paths, and I'm grateful to have dealt with that, you know, because I feel like I'm on solid ground now.
It's so strange to take that chance, because you do have to take those initial steps, of course, but then imposter syndrome starts to set in. You wonder, like, does anybody actually get it? But you do it enough over time, then gradually you look around and you realize that maybe if you haven't necessarily mastered something, you've at least figured it out enough to really be able to fight for yourself in certain battles.
Yeah, exactly. I think the imposter syndrome thing in particular, it's a big deal. But, you know, I feel bad for anyone who hasn't made any mistakes, because that's really when the growth happens, you know.
It's such a boring life if you've never made those mistakes. I pity those people too. Pity's not a great emotion to feel necessarily, but it's like, gosh, you have really not done a whole lot with your life. You just stayed on the straight and narrow. You've kept things very conservative, and this world is all about experiencing awe. It's easy to experience as a kid, right? I've got a 9 and 7 year old. You're married. Do you have kids at home?
We don't have kids yet, but we are. That's the next step, I think.
Okay, good luck with that. So at nine and seven, I see them experiencing less awe than they did several years ago, because the world is more comfortable to them. So even something as simple as like pressing a button to open an automatic door, let's say, like they used to fight one another for that. Now I see them just disinterested and waiting for me to hold the door for them. Yeah. Because I'm a nice dad. But we need to experience awe as adults as well, but it becomes much more difficult, especially if we remain in those comfort zones. So to talk to somebody else who understands that, the value of mistakes, and who is seeking out those new experiences, it's really cool to get to talk to you, one, but it's cool to see that manifest also with the music that you've made over the years too.
Yeah, I feel like I can understand where I was in the present moment on every album that I've made, you know.
And oh, like, interesting. Even listening back now, you're like, yeah, this is exactly where I was.
Exactly. And I think I can hear the problem solving, you know, not knowing how to get a sound that I liked, and just experimenting and figuring with being in my own head and not having any of the tools really to know how to get a certain sound or create a style or a musical trope, you know. In this album, I went back to school. I got a master's in music composition, and it really opened my mind up to how to create music in a way that was very foreign to me for a long time. And I think through that, I was really, really able to find my voice.
Technically speaking, how did it change how you go about creating music?
Well, when you study music, you start to understand the science of music. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing is really happenstance. You know, there are magical moments that exist in music, you know, when you do them on the fly, and that's like a very beautiful thing that we all as musicians like strive to achieve. But when you're creating music, when you're writing and composing, there's a language and there's a vocabulary, you know, to literally doing anything. You know, what you end up doing in music school is you analyze a lot of music, and you see like, oh, this is what Bach is doing, and this is how he created this, and what we know as this kind of formula for the music, you know, understanding the theory. And once you understand that, you can go back to the music that you love or songs that you love and see what they're doing. You know, like David Bowie wasn't just joking around, you know, Miles Davis, all these people that I'm inspired by, Sly Stone, all of them, they knew the science of music. They knew the understanding. Quincy Jones is a perfect example too. And you can go back and understand that and be able to have this conversation with these people by saying, oh, I see what you did there. Now, what can I do? What would that look like if I did that? You know, which is very different from before, where I would listen to something and just rip it off, just straight up like, oh, well, I'm just going to replay this thing, and then maybe I can reverse psychology or reverse like engineer how to understand how this is happening. But it was still a very, very foreign concept. But now it's like I can really break it down to a science of what's going on.
So I'm a sucker for a good falsetto. I guess I should preface this by asking, are you providing the falsetto in Syncane? Because there are a number of different singers on a given song, but you're doing the falsetto?
Pretty much the whole time is my falsetto. I think the song Invisible Distance and Everything is Everything with True Osborne singing, True provides the falsetto in Everything is Everything, but we share it on Invisible Distance, but 99% of the time it's me.
So whether you're talking about Born Ruffians, maybe the biggest reason why I love those guys, or Gary Clark Jr., or you, Ahmed, it takes something special to get that falsetto right. Is that something that you struggled with early in your time as a frontman, and what allowed you to get there? Was there a song or a moment where you had finally put enough hours in to where you hit it?
I think anyone who has a falsetto, like a male falsetto, might agree when I say the falsetto feels very comfortable to sing in. It's deceiving though, because it's really, really, it's like driving a car at like 120 miles an hour. It's really easy. If you just move one bit this way, you're off the rails, you know? But it's so satisfying, for me in particular, to sing in my falsetto. Just my body resonates in a way that it feels really good. And I think what really made me realize that I could do it was on Mean Love, on the album Mean Love. Mm. Especially the song Mean Love, because that's sang mostly in my falsetto.
Gonna stick a pin in the conversation on falsetto with Ahmed Jalib. He is better known by the stage name Syncane. Got a new album out as of today titled We Belong. I spoke with him at South by Southwest a few weeks ago, and you'll hear the second half of that conversation here on the other side on Sports Day Plus.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
Back for one more segment with musician Ahmed Jalib, better known by the stage name Syncane. Syncane has a new album out as of today. It's titled We Belong. And we start back up by finishing Syncane's thoughts on how to pull off that falsetto voice. It takes something special to get that falsetto right. Is that something that you struggled with early in your time as a frontman? And what allowed you to get there? Was there a song or a moment where you had finally put enough hours in to where you hit it?
I think anyone who has a falsetto, like a male falsetto, might agree when I say the falsetto feels very comfortable to sing in. It's deceiving though, because it's really, really, it's like driving a car at like 120 miles an hour. It's really easy. If you just move one bit this way, you're off the rails, you know? But it's so satisfying, it's for me in particular, to sing in my falsetto. It just, my body resonates in a way that it feels really good. And I think what really made me realize that I could do it was on Mean Love, on the album Mean Love, especially the song Mean Love, because that's sang mostly in my falsetto.
Yeah, you're right that it is a delicate balance, because I'm an amateur falsetto in the car with my family. Even if it's not a song that has falsetto, I go a little bit higher pitch just to try and hear how it sounds. And I get told by my family that it sounds like Screeching Cat. So congratulations on achieving that sort of enlightenment.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's polarizing. You know, there's a lot of people who tell me that they don't like it, and there's a lot of people who tell me they do like it. But I mean, the important thing is I like it, so.
Well, when you can strike a chord similar to like a Marvin Gaye or a Curtis Mayfield or a Stevie Wonder, which I think you are in that category now, then not to put too much pressure on you with the performance tonight, but I think it does get a little bit easier, and you also recognize that you can't please everybody too.
Exactly, exactly. It's important you just please yourself, really.
So you went to undergrad at Ohio State, correct?
Yes, I did, yep.
I don't know how big of a sports fan you are. Are you a big football fan?
I am a very big sports fan. My main is basketball, but being an Ohio State Buckeye, I very much followed college football.
Yeah, I talked to Evan Turner last week. That was a pretty big thrill.
Wow, that's amazing.
He's a cool freaking dude.
That's amazing. Yeah, I started, my freshman year was when Maurice Claret was playing. And
yeah, you guys got a national championship early in your time at Ohio State, right?
First year, yeah. That was one of the most surreal experiences I think I've ever experienced. Not because of the win, but because of the celebratory riots that existed. You know, it really showcased the energy of Ohio State fans and Ohio State students. It's pretty gnarly.
Scarier scene, war-torn Sudan, which you have seen. You would go there regularly as a kid with your family who have roots there during summer times, or post-Ohio State winning a national championship, or maybe even them just beating Michigan in the shoe on a given year.
Oh, I mean, those are two very different experiences. I don't know how easy it would be for me to compare or contrast the two, but I will say the Ohio State-Michigan game my freshman year after we won in the shoe, seeing people flip over cars and throw lit mattresses into the middle of the street was a pretty surreal experience. You know, after we won, that was pretty wild.
Yeah, I watch Americans do that in celebration or disgust for their sports teams, and it's like these acts that are being carried out other places in an effort to try and overthrow repressive regimes, of course, or for some other political reasons. It's like, man, we are spoiled here if this is how we take to the streets in that regard.
Yeah, yeah. It almost felt like going to an Eagles game or something. You know, it was pretty intense. It was like, as volatile as losing, you know, like a very angry person losing. But, you know, I don't know. Ohio State games were so much fun to go to. You know, going to a show, a game at the shoe was really something special. I mean, so massive, and like the communal energy there was really, really great.
You must have been there when Texas and Vince Young went in there and won that game.
I remember that day very vividly.
Yeah, there were a lot of Longhorn fans who disagree with you on how much fun it is going to the Horseshoe. Apparently, Ohio State fans were not taking too kindly to Longhorns that day.
Well, what was interesting about that game in particular, it was, you know, that was back when the Big Ten was the Big Ten. Yeah. You know, it wasn't, we didn't open it up. There was no one in anyone that we saw outside of the Big Ten was only at a bowl game,
yeah.
You know? So, and anytime we had anything to do outside of the Midwest was when we played the Fiesta Bowl, because for some reason we played the Fiesta Bowl every year for like 6 years straight or something.
Yeah, y'all were too good to play in the Rose Bowl a lot of years.
It was crazy. So that was a really special game for Ohio State fans, because it was the first time we had this like major market team come to Ohio. You know, we wouldn't ever, you know, I think the only other team that we had seen before that was Miami, you know, in the national championship game. So, and that was a national championship game. So it was really interesting to see that. And it was like a kind of fresh energy, and the UT fans that came were almost felt like aliens. It was like, oh, whoa, you guys are, who is this crop of sports fan that we are not used to at all, you know? Yeah. It's pretty weird.
Are you a fan of the direction that college football is headed and college sports in general with NIL, with the expansion of the playoff, and some of the other things that are that's going to entail?
I do like the college postseason. I think that's the structure of that is much more organized, I feel like, and not
as and forgiving too. By the way, you can lose a game now and you'll still be okay in terms of trying to pursue.
Like, yeah, you don't have to go undefeated the whole season and to even be considered for anything. The pressure is less. The whole NIL thing, I think, is very interesting, and I mean, it was bound to happen. You know, I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens with it, because I don't know what kind of incentive really exists to go pro for a majority of these players anymore. But like at the same time, there's such a small percentage of players that actually do go pro, so it really gives an opportunity for a good crop of people that really need it. You know. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
What's your favorite Ohio State basketball memory?
Oh, man. I don't really know. I mean, I think the one Ohio State basketball season that I really paid attention to is when Greg Oden was playing. And I didn't really follow it that much. I'm much more of a Cavs fan, much more of like a pro NBA sports fan. But
speaking of franchises that burn jerseys when their star goes from one place to another,
yeah, well, I definitely didn't agree with people when that happened. I was a little bummed out, but you know, LeBron James has Michael Jordan crawled so LeBron could walk, as far as basketball marketing is concerned, but he's really taken the business of basketball and turned it into something else. And that was a turning point in that, you know, in the history of basketball. And I don't think he should have done it, but, you know, whatever.
There's an interesting performative element to LeBron that a lot of people don't like. I just watch as an innocent bystander. I don't really care that much at this point. But I bring that up because David Bowie is one of your favorite artists. Obviously, a performative element there of Montreal. Also, very much performance art, too. What was the most performative thing that you did as a member of the traveling band of Montreal for a couple of years?
Most performative thing.
Or the most artistic thing that had less to do with the music and more to do with the show happening on stage.
So we dressed up, and once I got really comfortable dressing up, I really kind of took a nod to George Clinton and tried to like dress exactly like him. I had feather boas and long blonde wig and these really big sunglasses and just this wonderful thing. And I would do this thing in between the show and the encore where I'd come out and get the crowd to chant something. And it was this like stupid kind of like Animal House chant that my friends and I would do at Ohio State, where we'd say, what do we want? And we'd have people say, pizza. When do we want it? Pizza. So it was this back and forth, and I'd have a crowd of 2,000, 3,000 people doing this pizza chant, you know, as an ode to my friends. And it was a lot of fun.
I love the P-Funk nod. I had the pleasure of talking to Bootsy Collins the other day. That was surreal.
Yeah, we were about to run into him. We played at the Pace stage, and he was playing right afterwards, but I had to leave, and I was really bummed out. I mean, that guy's an idol.
Have you run into Bootsy or George before?
I ran into George a few times. We played Glastonbury Festival together and another festival in Taos, New Mexico. And I've been to his studio in Tallahassee, Florida, where he has the mothership in the middle of his studio. And I had the pleasure of taking a picture with the mothership. It was really nice.
In the middle of the studio?
In the middle of the live room, yeah.
Damn, that is wild. All right, last thing now, because as I said, We Belong is coming out April 5th. What do you hope people take away from this? I know you said that it's a tribute to black music, black culture, black people, and it's also a culmination of all these lessons that you've learned over time. What do you hope people walk away from after they've listened to this album, hopefully about 30,000 times?
I hope that they just walk away happy and enjoy the music, you know. I hope that they can understand that it's all about community. You know, one of my favorite things about Black culture and Black music is it's all about community. It's all about the conversation between all of us. And this is me starting the conversation with my fans or with these new people that decide to give Sin Cane a shot, you know, and I'd love to hear what they have to say.
Well, I think what they have to say is going to be very positive. And thank you so much for the time today, man. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much, my friend.
And that was my conversation from South by Southwest with Ahmed Jalib, better known by the stage name Sin Cane, a very talented musician who's got a new album out now called We Belong. Get it now wherever you listen to music. And that is it for another week of Sports Day Plus. Thank you so much for tuning in. Programming note, I will be out on Monday traveling back from West Texas and stopping off around Kerrville for that total eclipse. We'll be back on Tuesday. That includes a conversation with Margaret Cho, who's taking part in Moon Tower Comedy Festival this year. In the meantime, have yourselves a great weekend and hook 'em.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.